It's my pleasure to introduce Kate Thorpe. Kate is a poet completing her PhD at Princeton. A little part-time teaching in there, right? So, and has been coming to Holden since she was 10. Wow. And loves Holden. So we're so happy to have her. First time teaching.
Wow. And we're happy to.
You're going to be outside, inside, learning lots. So thank you very much, Kate.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
We'll keep the doors open. If it does get noisy, somebody can just shut up.
Really.
So perfect.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being here on this beautiful, such a beautiful day. I'm in the middle of my dissertation right now. I'm writing on 18th century poetry and this weird old-fashioned figure called personification. Does anyone know what that is, that trope?
Personification? Mm-hmm.
Just going back to like middle school or like days of, Chess, is that?
Yeah. You give inanimate object human, like a human traits.
Yeah.
Bingo. Nailed it.
Yeah, exactly.
A rising high schooler.
Yeah.
There you go.
Awesome.
What year are you?
In ninth grade. Yeah.
Oh.
Wow.
Right.
You're going into ninth grade?
Yeah.
And you've already had enough poetry to know that? Wow.
It's similar to anthropomorphic.
It is similar. There's all of these kind of tropes that it's related to. So it's often categorized as a kind of metaphor, like a specific type, because you're comparing nature to humans or humans to nature.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a specific form of metaphor. Prosopopeia is also connected to personification. Prosopopeia is like, it's an older trope, a classical trope, bringing back to life someone who's dead or calling someone into the presence who's absent. Apostrophe, there are all of these kind of related tropes. But I just wanted to kind of say that I'm in the middle of this writing process, and I'm really excited to talk with you about like a part of the like a kind of questions that are fueling the dissertation. And it's really exciting to be able to bring it outside of like my, you know, my Carol in the Library. to think about these questions like in actual Holden, like in nature, and with you all. That's kind of where this comes out of. And also my experience, I care about how to think about nature. My experience growing up, like coming to the mountains every summer and hiking a lot. So that's kind of where the project actually started, is how to describe nature, how to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And what are the problems of the ways humans have interacted with nature? How can
mm-hmm.
we interact and have more, how can we have recuperative relationships with nature? So that's the kind of like some of where I'm coming from. I'm living right now in New Jersey, in Princeton, but I grew up in Seattle. And we'll be looking at a Mary Oliver poem, The Last Day.
Nice.
So I'm really glad that, I'm really excited to talk about it with you and, hear what you think.
Question,
yeah.
is this the only class that you're doing?
No, so I'm doing, there's a class today, and then it's Tuesday, Thursday, and Thursday at 2 and Friday at 3:30. And so what I'm thinking is that today we'll focus on 18th century poetry, and we'll do a writing exercise. And then Thursday we'll turn to 19th century poetry, to Wordsworth, so like basically at the end of 18th century, and do a writing exercise in relation to that. And then Friday we'll look at more contemporary, so like mid-20th century to contemporary poetry, and then also doing a writing exercise. So basically I'm interested in charting how poets have represented nature and how these representations have shifted over time. It's a really complicated set of questions. And the 18th century is really interesting because of the rise, it's also the time of the rise of the Enlightenment and industrialization. And the history of science is so related to the history of poetry, and figurative language is related to scientific language, to looking closely at nature.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's a really interesting time. A lot of people don't read 18th century poetry, but actually it's like really weird and cool.
Weird and cool.
And all of these questions are very complicated and lead to lots of tangles. So one thing that I did in preparing is I tried to untangle some of the like some of the premises here. And in the, I decided to err on the side of like, like getting to the ground rather than like high up. So I just wanted to like start with this really basic definition of representation. Now this is like a super theoretical term. There are tons of people who write on this, but I just want to like get down to like bare bones, like what it means to describe something, just so we have some terms laid out. So that's the first thing that I have up here, representation. So you have something like an original. You have like a tree that a poet is looking at. That's the kind of like original, actual thing that a representation is based on. And then there's this other thing that's the description, the nature that's described by the poet in language. So there are two things. There's the original, and then there's the representation, the description. And that it's and that description, the fact of describing an original, puts the poet in relationship to nature. So by describing the tree, the poet is in relationship to that original tree. And what I'm curious about in this class is thinking through what the nature of that relationship is. How does poetic description create a relationship? What does it look like? Is it recuperative? Is it somehow, is it a projection of the poet's experience onto nature, what to make, how to make sense of that relationship. So I, there, all this tangle, I tried to like map out into three questions. So the first is, what relationship to nature is created when a poet describes? And what relationship is created for the poet, so the actual person who's doing the writing, for the speaker in the poem? So in a poem, you often have an eye, a perspective that is seeing nature, but that person in the poem is not necessarily the poet, and we often call that person the speaker. So it can be, like in Wordsworth, often it is the poet, right? He's like describing his experience. We're going to talk about Tintern Abbey on Thursday, and he's describing his experience looking at this prospect, this place that he's been to. 5 years have passed, right? He begins the poem, like since he last saw this place. So there's often overlap between the speaker and poet, but they're not necessarily the same person. Okay, so what relationship is created for speaker, for poet, and then also for the reader of the poem? Okay. Number two, what's the role of figurative language in creating this relationship? So there are all of these different ways of describing nature, and often figurative speech is one way that poets describe. And I'm thinking, so we talked like at the very beginning when I was introducing myself about personification. So figurative speech, right, metaphors, similes, all these different ways of imagining and using words to imagine something out of what is seen. And I was thinking about this with when Wes, like in Wes's Bible study yesterday, when he was talking about the relationship between like the doctrinal truth versus images. If you got, I don't know if you were there, he was describing the difference between a doctrinal truth and then images.
A doctrinal truth?
Doctrinal truth?
Doctrinal
like
truth,
doctrine,
yes.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Versus a kind of the way that Jesus, he was saying, describes God or the kingdom of heaven in the Bible. So he was saying often this happens through figures, through the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. So that like moves us into figurative speech. And I'm specifically interested in personification because as a trope, turning nature, making, comparing nature to humans, it's a way of specifically thinking through or thinking about the relationship between humans and nature. So that's a trope I'll kind of keep coming back to and asking about, just because it like puts to the forefront this question about what poetic description does. And often nature is personified in like really direct overt ways or like really subtle ways so that you don't even quite realize that that's what's happening. Okay, so what's the role of figurative language? And then three, what is the status of the representation that's created? Is it objective? Like, is it nature itself? like this kind of science, if we think of like scientific objectivity as a kind of unmediated, direct, specific, yeah. Or is it subjective? Like, is it the poet's point of view projected onto nature? Is it a kind of emotional experience that the poet is having, thinking about nature? If you're on the walk today, I was thinking about this a lot in terms of responses. At the very end of the walk, Heather was so helpful, so wonderful. She asked us to respond to, like, what was the experience of, what was the experience of writing about nature or experience it or, like, being there? And many people compared it to their own experience or where they were in their lives. So it's a question that I'm asking, like, what does that look like? Is it subjective? Or, and another third option, and these can all happen at once also, like it's not either or, but just to put some options on the table, is godly or devotional? And in the 18th century especially, this is a really important concept. Scholars have thought for a really long time, one of the really basic understandings of the 18th century is that as science and empiricism develops, so does secularism and secularization. So increasingly the century becomes secularized. But right now scholars are really complicating that perspective and saying actually these things are totally intertwined. And another premise alongside that is that scientific language is not figurative, right? That like there are these thinkers, John Locke says this, Thomas Spratt, is like the beginning of science, the Royal Society, it says, you know, argues against figurative language. Like we're going to describe nature objectively, right? Get away those metaphors, they're lies. But actually, so there's been this idea in 18th century studies that there's this real split between figurative speech on the one hand, poetic speech, subjective, emotional, sublime, all of these terms you hear about poetry, or objective speech on the other hand, scientific discourse. And we see that split today, right? Like in so many different ways. The gendered split, there's all these different ways you can think about that split. But actually, I think it's so interesting that 18th century scholars right now are pointing to really close relationships between scientific discourse and poetic discourse and arguing, really showing how poets are deeply seeped and saturated in scientific, like, models of empiricism. What's empiricism? I'm, like, throwing out that really big word. What is that, like, what does that trigger for you?
Empirical data.
Empirical data? Yeah, what's
like
empirical
touchable,
data?
Touchable,
yes.
Measurable.
Measurable, yeah. Touchable. Yep. What else? Other associations?
Observable.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. So empiricism, the idea that that everything, like Locke's idea of empiricism, like everything that we are impressed by on our senses, by the external world, and that's how we learn, and that we need to observe, that we need to look at what's actually there rather than applying like ideas that are preconceived. So yeah, observation, observed and like data driven.
Like ghosts, is ghost an empirical or subjective?
Such a good question. Such a good question. And so poets writing about death, for example, have this, are like putting really overlapping in really complicated ways at like what's observed, what's experienced by the senses, and what's subjective. And what about when the senses lie, when we think we hear something? Or when the mind imagines hearing something, or when the mind, like, what does it mean to observe the mind and how the mind works? That's both, it's both objective and subjective. Anyway, I'm getting way off track, but yeah.
Well, the other thing I love is science used to view it as you did experiments and you had this observable phenomena. And now they've come to understand that just the act of observation changes
yes.
what we're looking at. So
yes.
you can't
right.
you can't make it other. You can't make it purely objective. Just
totally.
Just putting human energy directed toward it changes.
Yeah. It's like to me it's like you have a certain pair of glasses And so you're still gonna have that impact of them coming through that pair of glasses.
Yes.
And you don't even know you're
doing it. And you don't even know you're doing it.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, so there's this real enmeshment or entanglement.
Exactly.
So if you describe life in nature,
mm-hmm.
is that your pair of glasses?
Yeah.
Or is that life that's actually in nature?
Yeah.
Are you animating? Are you describing? And if you're going to think about the devotional perspective, are you bringing readers? Are you bringing yourself closer to the book of nature? Something that's this term that was a really kind of medieval term and really important
mm-hmm.
in the 18th century. What's the book of nature? Yeah, good. Yeah.
Well, yeah,
question.
I mean, you have the book of scripture, which
uh-huh.
points to God, but then the book of nature is this term of general revelation. So you learn about God from observing and living in the world around you.
Oh,
and it became really important with the onset of empiricism to think that there was that writers argued for the link between empiric, because people, when this organization called the Royal Society, which was like a mid-17th century organization that was involved in experiments and trying out empirical models
mm-hmm.
of seeing the world,
mm-hmm.
It was very controversial because of religious questions. And they argued, no, this is actually, getting us closer to God. Because of close observation through a microscope, through
mm-hmm.
a telescope,
mm-hmm.
helps us to understand the book of nature better.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's these really close connections between
mm-hmm.
devotion, subject to, like, seeing, and then this the actual
mm-hmm.
objective thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally intertwined and intermeshed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm kind of curious about, is like how that stickiness works. It's very
mm-hmm.
sticky.
Mm-hmm.
And poetry is such a good way to think, to work with that stickiness,
yes.
because of how figurative language works. And so poets are really, I think, pushing at these boundaries and exploring and experimenting,
mm-hmm.
Which is why the poems can be kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you just hit on something right there where you said about curiosity, because
yes.
curiosity is what drives scientists.
Yes.
What
yes.
is this,
exactly.
Or what makes
yeah,
this
right.
work this way, and poets
yes.
the same way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just want to back up for 1 minute and just say that right now, so I think these questions are particularly important and relevant right now, given where we are in our world, with this epoch that people have termed the Anthropocene. Yuval, have you heard? What's the Anthropocene? Is that a term people know?
The Anthropocene era.
Yeah, the
yeah.
Anthropocene era. It's
well,
been
man is
exactly.
Affecting.
It's the geologic
yeah.
era that we're a part of. The
yes.
geologists have called the geologic era this new term, the Anthropocene.
How do you spell that?
Yeah.
Anthropocene. By the way, make sure by Thursday you get new markers, because
yes.
these
oh,
old
they are not
yeah.
I can
yeah.
only read your number two.
They're, oh my gosh, seriously. Oh.
They're tired.
So
yeah.
I'm glad you read everything out
yeah.
loud, because then
okay.
I voted
thank
yeah,
you for that.
Okay.
I was a little afraid.
I don't think
well,
my camera fits.
Jess is fine. So when there's young people in the room,
yeah.
you can use those old
yeah,
markers.
But
so
those of us who need our little readers.
So bad.
You got it when I said it out loud. Okay,
yeah, yeah.
Okay, so Anthropocene, yeah, so I think like anthro is human, right?
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
then is this like era?
Yeah.
Is anyone
saying
this Latin?
The
yeah.
human era.
Yeah.
Current human era.
Yeah, exactly. So they've called, the geologists have called, created this new term for the geologic era that we're a part of, which basically means that humans have radically changed the way the Earth works and is structured. Yeah. And people date the Anthropocene, the beginning of it, at different times.
Mm-hmm.
Some people date it to the beginning of wheat and like Neolithic.
Oh,
thank
Neolithic.
You. Neolithic
oh,
era,
the
right? So way back, the beginning
yeah,
of agriculture.
Uh-huh.
But other people date it to in the industrial
yeah.
period,
right.
which
mm-hmm.
is 18th century.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And coming
right
off of Enlightenment science
yeah.
and viewing the world, viewing the Earth in a particular like in a particularly mechanical way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I think for now, given where we are now, our relationship, the fact that we are relating, we are in relationship to nature is inevitable. Like that relationship, the fact of it is a given right now. We can't.
Some people deny it.
Some people deny it, absolutely. But it seems the vast majority of scientists, that we really are, like, we are in relationship to nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems really important to think through what that relationship is, what it entails. I think it's because of the connections between the kind of subjective projection of human experience onto nature,
mm-hmm.
It's a really complicated, what poetic description does is really complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think, tainted or somehow
mm-hmm.
connected to this question of viewing the world as an exploitable resource.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
How do we treat nature? How do we view nature?
Mm-hmm.
Is totally bound up with this question of describing nature, of representing nature.
Mm-hmm.
And then that, like, tangibly when we mine out copper, for example, right? Like, Holden is
mm-hmm.
such a good place to think through these questions because
mm-hmm.
we're right on the boundary of a beautiful, pristine natural environment, but also an environment that's been changed by human beings. So that's part of the set, like that's part of the the question or the motive that underlies these questions for me,
mm-hmm.
Is how do we use this? How do we think about description in a way that can be not just destructive but also recuperative?
Mm-hmm.
Given that we can't just destructive, but recuperative.
Got it.
Yeah. Given that we can't just walk away and say, like, oh, we're not going to touch it. We're not going to touch nature. Like, that's just not, it's not on the table. So poetry
no, not
seems
if you're
like
gonna
a.
Eat tonight.
Exactly. Exactly. And we are, and humans are, of course, animals living in nature. So that's another, I mean, obviously that, even that distinction is a creation of this era,
right?
Of like creating nature as this separate thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's happening at this,
mm-hmm.
in the 18th century with the move towards, and earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that I expanded on my parents, like, how to describe what I'm trying to do, and they got very confused. So, does this... And my mom was like, map this out into three questions.
Parents are hard.
Can we have a witness?
I have a vested interest in you. This feels very clear to me.
Good, okay, great. Well, if you have questions, please just let me know. So I said already that we're doing 18th century today, 19th century, then 20th century. Let's start reading. I wanted to give you two examples, like examples of how scientific language is totally bound up with figurative language and poetic language with scientific language. So that's where we're going to start. So Robert Hooke. Has anyone heard of Robert Hooke?
English.
What do you know about him?
Honestly, I have forgotten probably most of what I knew, but
magnification.
Was he the microscope?
The microscope.
Oh
yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So he worked with this this organization called the Royal Society.
Yeah.
Oh, the Royal Society.
Royal Society of Magnification.
It's mid 17th century. I don't remember exactly the date, but it's like it's right in the middle of the 17th century. And I think it was through the transition period to the revolution and all of the political turmoil. I think it lasted through that time period. But anyway, so he was lower class than the people who were working in the society. That's not super important, but anyway, he was like an assistant. He was like helping out, and he wrote this book called Micrographia. Using the early microscope to basically meticulously describe all sorts of objects and little critters, man-made objects, natural objects, and he would draw what he saw in the microscope, and then describe it with language.
Uh-huh.
So I gave you just one of these descriptions. Of the flea, it's a particularly great one.
Of the flea?
Of the flea. And I'd like to read, let's see. So I'm just going to like quickly do a quick skim of the first paragraph and then we'll really focus on the second one. So he's basically just like describing it. The strength and beauty of this small creature, had it no other relation at all to man, would deserve a description. For its strength, the microscope is able to make no greater discoveries of it than the naked eye, but only the curious contrivance of its legs and joints. For the exerting that strength is very plainly manifested, such as no other creature I have yet observed has anything like it. He describes the different parts, its four legs. He like labels the parts in the diagram. Mm-hmm. The parts of the hinder leg bend one within the other, like the parts of a double-jointed ruler, or like the foot, leg, and thigh of a man. These six legs he clitches up all together, and when he leaps, springs them all out, and thereby exerts his whole strength at once. And Joan, would you pick up from there?
Sure.
Let's read the next paragraph.
But as for the beauty of it, the microscope manifests it to be all over adorned with a curiously polished suit of sable armor. Neatly jointed and beset with multitudes of sharp pins, shaped almost like porcupine's quills or bright conical steel bodkins. The head is either side beautified with a quick and round black eye, K, behind each of which appears a small cavity, L, in which he seems to move to and fro a certain thin film beset with many small transparent hairs, which probably may be his ears. In the forepart of his head, between the two forelegs, he has two small, long, jointed feelers, or rather smellers, MM, which have four joints and are hairy, like those of several other creatures.
Great, let's stop there. Awesome, thank you so much. So yeah, what do you notice about this description?
It is like.
Yes. Yeah, what kinds of things does he compare the flea to?
Sable armor.
Sable armor.
You know, some of those adjectives are so evocative of many more things.
Yes.
When you hear sable,
I have no idea what that is.
Good. Well,
sable armor.
Well, yeah, I mean, but to think of an animal
sable
with
a fur, but it's.
I mean, it's, yeah, it's a juxtaposition.
You
wouldn't have sable armor.
Exactly. How can you do that?
Yeah.
So true. Yeah. So what is the armor? What is comparing the to armor? What does that do? What does it suggest or imply?
Well, humans wear armor.
Military.
Yeah, we do it in battle.
Yep.
But I have to say, for me, it made the flea more approachable.
Great. Why? Oh, how so? What about that makes it more approachable?
It's the curiosity in which he is talking about his flea. But also, it's also those little words like, he clitches up together and he leaps, springs them all out. Those adjectives that kind of make him endearing in a way. Just kind of like, what a fun little
creature,
you know? And please bite me. So,
right.
To me, he's so admiring of it.
Yes.
He's smitten with
it. Exactly.
This is the coolest thing.
He uses terms we are familiar with. It's not foreign. Look at this sucker.
Yes.
It is so foreign.
Yes.
But yet uses terms that we are familiar with to go, oh, wow, I can relate to that.
But the choices of words to me, like when you say sable and you say clitches up together and leaps, springs them all. I mean, those adjectives, it evoke a different feeling response for me as a reader.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also, I just think, imagine how wondrous it was to have this new instrument that can show somebody all these things that nobody ever noticed before. I mean, how exciting is that?
Oh, man. I can see it.
Well,
dude, look at this.
And then he talks about either side beautified.
Right.
With a quick and round black eye. And these transparent hairs. I mean, you don't go like that. It's like, oh, And he says, oh, these jointed feelers, or rather smellers. So it's kind of like he's just this kind of innocent, kind of approachable critter, you know?
And then he goes on, like, the parts of a double-jointed ruler, or like the foot, leg, and thigh of a man.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden we're right into human anatomy, or a ruler that everyone would be familiar with.
Totally.
You know, I just thought, what would have been our response to the flea if he would have described it like... and the face of a demon.
Which he could have done, because about the same time Milton writing Paradise Lost, right, personified, so Satan as a character, sin, death, he would have had all of the medieval morality plays at his disposal. That he could have done that.
Strong, multi-jointed legs that leap upon and devour its prey. You know?
Well, I'm also thinking of stuff like Men in Black, where you have all these big beasts that burst out of people. And the faces and all that.
Yeah.
I mean, just that
so what is it? What does it do when he sets aside the predisposed ideas of the thing? And start and thinks through, what is this thing? What does it look like? But he doesn't just describe, he doesn't just use descriptive descriptors.
Right.
He uses similes,
as
you pointed out, like to make it familiar, to make it so.
Did they know the connection between the Black Death and the flea at that point, or was that not? I don't think they knew that. I wonder how that might have shaped.
So they used the flowers and stuff,
still,
the smell, so they wouldn't get that scent.
But it was still focusing on humors,
a little bit of bleeding out. The flea isn't really associated with a terrible disease.
Right, that's true. Yeah, an annoyance, maybe.
Yeah.
That's a really good question, what it would have been associated with. I just, totally don't know.
Well, my husband, who is a scientist, he's a scientist and he has a very strong faith, but there, and he says, well, I don't, you know, people say, well, you can't be a scientist, you can't believe in science and have a faith in God. And he just doesn't get that. It's like, you know, you're observing all these things that God's created. And
there's a wonder.
Wonder. And we can see that here.
That he's talking about the flea.
And the language of aesthetics, the language of beauty, helps to express that wonder, as you've all pointed out. Which I think is, so I've never quite saw that before.
Just how the tone is very much one of wonder.
So I'd like to think about that passage now in relationship to a mid-century, kind of early to mid-century poem by James Thompson called The Seasons. Has anyone heard of this poem? It's really long. It's this epic book-length poem. Really, really popular through the 18th and 19th
centuries. How much of it are you going to read?
Exactly.
We have to get our screen.
We are going to look at one, like, very, very small passage.
Okay.
So do not worry. So Thompson is really interesting because he is just basically describing the four seasons. So there's this section on winter. All the four seasons have their own section. And people have talked about a kind of like overload of the senses, like a kind of like overwhelming feeling of this poem. So anyway, I'm curious as to whether you feel that way. So we'll talk about it. Okay, so this is from autumn. He's describing the onset of nightfall and night. At this point, let's see. Let's just read that, the stanza that starts, like, basically where the asterisks are, in 1082. So, Jackie, would you mind? Okay, so
I see what you mean.
1082, so it's right where the star is, the western sun.
The western sun withdraws the shortened day, and amid evening, gliding o'er the sky, in her chill progress to the ground condensed, the vapors throws, where creeping waters ooze, where marshes stagnate, and where rivers wind, cluster the rolling fogs and swim along. The dusky mantled lawn, meanwhile the moon, full orbed and breaking through the scattered clouds, shows her broad visage in the crimsoned east. turn to the sun direct her spotted disk, where the mountains rise, umbrageous dales descend, and oceans roll as optic tube describes. A smaller earth,
like seeing like seas.
Yeah. Okay. A smaller earth gives all his blaze again, void of its flame, and sheds a softer day. Now through the passing cloud she seems to stoop. Now up the pure cerulean rides sublime. Wide the pale deluge floats, and streaming mild o'er the skied mountain to the shadowy vale. While rocks and floods reflect the quivering gleam, the whole air whitens with a boundless tide of silver radiance, trembling round the world.
Great, thank you so much. You did a beautiful job.
Wow. Ooh, wow.
What was it like to read that out loud?
A lot of words,
yeah.
Number one. A lot of description, but some... it just was a lot going on in there. A lot going
That's
on.
That's so right. It's like such a good way to talk about it. Yeah, there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
What kinds of things are going on?
Well, I'm kind of sensitized now to personification because of your work. I was struck with Earth him because I'm normally used to thinking of Earth as her.
Yeah.
But the chill, the humid evening gliding over the sky and her chill progress.
Yeah. So he's personifying.
Yeah.
Yes.
And him a gender.
Totally.
Yeah.
He's even just through in very subtle ways through pronouns. And the English language really, bless you, is very helpful for personification. Like when you say his or her in the English language, it creates personification because we could say it's,
yeah.
Which isn't true, right, in Romance languages.
Yeah.
But it is really true in English. So, yeah. Yeah, so definitely personifying. What
well,
is, yeah.
It was kind of like there, it almost was like I was looking at a picture. It was like one snapshot and then trying to just fill in with words the whole scenery with everything that's going on there, just describing what is in this one moment.
Oh, see, I had an image, but it was of a movie. Because I could see her traveling, you know, it's like noticing more and more
as the day is changing.
I was going to say, like, is it static? Are they things in stasis that we observe?
No, it wasn't because there was a movement. There was a movement of the sun descending and the moon coming up and the stuff flowing and oozing and all like that.
Yeah.
But I saw it like as if... I'm looking at a picture, and I see all this stuff that's happening up there because I see this, and it's like, anyway, that's where I am.
Yeah.
Your both comments are so helpful together because on the one hand, it helps to suggest there's a boundary.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That it's
mm-hmm.
just bounded.
Yes. Yes.
We have lines. We have like it is in iambic pentameter.
Mm-hmm.
It's like we definitely have. Structure
mm-hmm.
here.
Mm-hmm.
It's a containment.
Well, here it'll be like one snippet of a show.
Right.
And here I have this one picture inside a frame.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I have to agree with the comment you made from people who've read this.
Yeah.
So I'm stuck on.
Yeah.
Overload of senses.
Yes.
Because... Yeah, it's like I want an economy of words to describe
mm-hmm.
that. Maybe that's our culture now.
Mm-hmm.
We just want to
mm-hmm.
get to the cut to the chase.
Mm-hmm.
Just give me the picture in less verbiage.
I can see why you had a book of this.
Yes, and there is a whole, like, I mean, I've now read this poem multiple times,
uh-huh.
and it is really hard for me as a 21st century reader
yes.
to read.
Yes.
So I'm curious about what makes it difficult. Like, what kinds of words seem like an overload? Or
for me, it's not so much the words.
It's the rhythm.
But it's the rhythm.
Yeah, the rhythm.
It is comma after comma. So it's like set off.
Yeah.
So I just get one idea, and then I'm set off to the next thing.
Exactly.
And then, so it's all these encapsulations.
Yeah.
And it's hard for me to take in the totality because I'm broken into track all these little snippety bit.
There's like one thing and then another.
And you read that really beautifully.
Well, thank
you.
I was thinking I was actually thinking as my musician self, if I were a singer singing those words, how would they flow? But even then it was troublesome. I was going, I was trying to say, what's the flow
phrase
here?
Within a phrase.
The flow here.
Yeah,
and some of the words that I got stuck on were some were pronunciation because I'm going, I don't think, is it that? And then it was just because it was so laden with adjectives.
Yes, adjectives.
Adjectives.
Yeah, and this is one way people talk about 18th century poetry is through an overload or many, many adjectives that describe nouns.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I have this prayer, and it starts out, God, isn't your creation wasteful? The water from the creek spills out over the rocks, and the seeds are just flying through the air. So it made me think of the abundance of God and creation.
Well, I was being kind of analytical.
Well, no, I mean, everything's valid.
Yeah, I know, but
and Kevin, so there's a scholar who's written on this poetry, and basically she argues that he is describing, they said, what we would see through a microscope or a telescope, and the overabundance of stimuli, and how
how terrifying that is.
And how vulnerable human senses are.
Yeah.
That humans actually become vulnerable to the overwhelming stimuli of the world. That just is like oversaturation of our senses.
That's how I feel when I go to Costco.
I always have to go to Costco with another person because I just get too overwhelmed. Yeah, but it's like, it is like that.
Free samples.
Yeah. Getting
so close. Like, speed plays a role. Because I'm close enough to the church I serve that I often drive, but I can walk. And it's an entirely different experience, you know, driving.
Yeah.
You see very little. When you walk, I mean, you see every little thing, I suppose.
Totally.
And I think about the pace of life. Like, to have the ability
to see that detail.
To see this detail about the night sky.
Absolutely.
Just saying, night fell.
Yeah.
Sun came up. Moon came up.
Intimacy that
I
don't have with the natural world.
Right. And then it can go on. The patience.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this poem
mm-hmm.
takes so much patience
to
read. It really does. And the fact that it was so popular in the 18th century, really important to Wordsworth, really important romantic poet in the 19th century, and a lot of the 19th, it's a really important poem, and then it just dissipates.
Yeah.
Just falls away. So I think that that's really interesting in terms of like differences of like our expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about differences in expectations with Wordsworth on Thursday.
Yeah.
Of like in terms of what we, it's like a, it's also aesthetics, what we expect as readers of poetry.
Yeah.
Well, excuse me, anticipation or what expectations of who?
Yeah, good question.
That's
of who?
What percentage of people were literate and reading this back then? You know,
so literacy
was becoming. You've got peasants.
Yeah.
You don't have public education.
Totally.
So
and
this is
right.
what the high caste people.
And increasingly
reading.
Over the 18th century, more and more people were reading, and books were becoming more and more widespread and available.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really important, it's actually a really, really big problem for 18th century poets. As the as poetry was moving from, I always forget this term, why do I always forget this? Patronage. From a patronage system to a capitalist corporate system. And poets were really, there was a lot of pressure on poets to like perform a poetic identity or create a poetic identity. That's another kind of question, but it's really totally connected. That readership is radically changing. Who's reading? And a lot of women are now reading poems and writing poems. One super quick note before we move to a woman writing. Yes. what's an optic tube?
Well, there's a note down here
it's
in the bottom.
Yeah.
The
Aurora Borealis.
An optic tube. It's line 1093. I just want to note that, that it's a telescope. That he's actually describing a telescope. in this, in like what we see through a telescope.
An optic tube.
Optic tube.
Optic tube.
Well, maybe that didn't even have a name.
Optic tube.
No, I don't know. That's a great question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's such a new thing.
Yeah, totally. I totally don't know.
An optic tube.
Yeah. Yeah. So even scientific instruments are in this very passage.
Oh, it says right here.
So I just wanted to really quickly point that out.
It does.
I've got an optic tube in my room.
Okay, alright, so we're moving on. Yes, we're moving on to Anne Finch. Okay, so we're going to now look at a whole poem, then we're going to do a writing exercise. So the next page is this poem called A Nocturnal Reverie. And so now, increasingly in 18th century studies, scholars are reviving the many 18th century female poets that were writing and reading. So huge, increasing female readership, but a lot of, because of the shift from patronage to publishing, female poets were suddenly not just writing, but also publishing for the first time, and well-read. So Anne Finch was a higher, upper-class poet, and she was affiliated with the I'm like not good at talking about history, but really affiliated with the earlier regime before the revolution of 1688. So anyway, there's like all sorts of political turmoil in England in the mid 17th century. There's one revolution, another order takes power. Then that order is pushed from power in 1688 without violence. The first revolution, I think 1660, is violent. The second one is not. But Anne Finch, but everyone in that order has to swear a loyalty oath. And Anne Finch is married to Count Winchelsea? Count something like that. And he does not swear the loyalty oath, so they are really elevated, right, very much connected to court as a countess, and then they are exiled. So she's writing these poems in exile, staying in the country. Now, in the countryside, at her cousin's estate, it's like a beautiful natural estate, and so writing basically in reclusion, writing these poems, typed like written out by her husband, so really like lovely support there, which is really wonderful. And she published in the early 18th century, so this was published in 1713. And then really published in anthologies through the 18th century. So like Wordsworth read her like well read, which is really super interesting. Anyway, so it's helpful to know that she's writing this in a context of like in nature, basically not in courtly life. So let's just read the first. I'm gonna start with the first 14 lines. So if you see like the line numbers just on the left, so I want to read until like right before line 15. Let's see, we're at Robert, right? Would you mind reading?
And where are we starting again?
We're starting in such a night.
Okay.
A nocturnal reverie.
We're starting on 14?
At the beginning, just line 1.
And going to 14.
In such a night, and we're going to go to 14.
Got
and
it.
And if you
okay.
could think about how she's describing nature, we've just talked about Thompson,
uh-huh.
with a later poem, slightly later poem, but how is she describing nature?
Okay. In such a night, when every louder wind is to its distance cavern safe confined, and only gentle zephyr fans his wings, the lonely Philomel still waking sings, or from some tree famed for the owl's delight, she howling, hollowing clear, directs the wanderer's right. In such a night, when passing clouds give place, or thinly veil the heaven's mysterious face, when in some river overhung with green, the waving moon and trembling leaves are seen, when freshened grass now bears itself upright, and makes cool banks to pleasing rest invite, whence springs the woodbine and the bramble rose, and where the sleepy cowslip shelter grows.
Great, thank you so much. Okay, so how what do you notice about nature here. Objective, subjective? Are there places that seem objective? Are there places that seem subjective?
Well, in Fanciful, the zephyr wing fans its wings.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Fanciful. Yep. Fanciful. Yep. Good. Yep. And referring to a classical imagery, mm-hmm. The zephyr, the west winds. Yeah.
In line 6, she hollowing clear directs the wanderer.
Yes, who is she?
So is that the zephyr?
Or the owl.
Or the owl.
Oh. Let's see. And lonely Philomel still waking sings. Or from, well, who is Philomel?
I should know.
The merchant that
the nightingale.
The lonely Philomel.
Yeah.
What is the Philomel?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so it's a myth, a classical myth.
It's a story of a woman who lost her voice and was transformed into a nightingale.
Oh. So she's calling it a name. She's giving the nightingale a name, a classical name of a person.
Wow. The Philomel still waking sings, or from some tree famed for the owl's delight. Philomel. The bird.
Yeah.
Directs the wanderer right.
Directs the wanderer right. What kind of verb is directs?
Kind of bird directs.
What kind of verb? What kind of word? Yeah.
It's
directs.
Something that has hierarchy to it a little bit. Active. Giving instruction.
Yeah. Say that, sorry?
It's an active indicative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's active.
Yeah.
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 Like it, like the, what, like what is it assuming of the nightingale?
Yeah.
Power.
What does it assume? Power?
Mm-hmm.
What else? Great.
Intentionality.
Yeah. Envision too.
Directs.
Directs that it knows. It knows
it's
where.
Especially
since
they direct.
Yeah,
wisdom.
Right.
Wisdom.
Totally.
Directs right.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Great. Yeah. So we have this the nightingale that's really intentional. What about the wanderer? Or a better way of asking that question is. What sign is there of humans in this landscape?
Just the
personification.
Yeah, yeah.
And
we have the personification, absolutely.
Yeah.
And what else?
Also, because in you saying that, I was like, that makes cool banks to pleasing rest invite. So I'm assuming there is somebody wandering along the way that she's directing.
Totally.
But, you know, that this is a place, a human is.
Well, I look back at the title, A Nocturnal Reverie.
Yeah.
So if this is nighttime, it's quiet.
Yep.
No,
yep.
It is full of things going on.
So
yes. And what kinds of things are going on? What kinds of things? Are they humans?
Humans
talking and laughing or playing?
It's nature.
It's nature.
Nature's talking.
Nature's talking and moving. Yeah.
Unless we're the wanderer.
Yeah.
We could be a human wanderer.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Great. So there's this wanderer. What other sign do we have of any humans at all? Like, how do we get this description?
Veils heaven's mysterious face.
Great. Yeah. So in such a night, when passing clouds give place, or thinly veil the heaven's mysterious face. So what does that suggest? Like, what is she talking about?
That God is...
Like, what would be a non-devotional way of talking about that? Like, what object is she actually
referring
to?
That the stars are getting covered up by clouds.
Yes,
yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How blunt.
Yeah.
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 Should I be a poet?
You are the poet. You are the blunt poet.
But humans are very, I mean, so we also have our scene, the waving moon and trembling leaves are seen.
Yes.
So someone is seeing.
Mm-hmm. And reporting it.
And reporting it.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you make of the fact that we don't have I see, or we see, or he, she's, are seen?
It's passive.
It's passive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So humans are kind of like pushed to the background here.
Mm-hmm.
We have a wanderer. We don't have a person. We don't have a personal named person. We have a named nightingale.
Yeah,
not
that's the most personal we get.
It is the most personal we get.
In the west wind has the name.
Yeah. And the heavens, the sky has the name Heaven's Mysterious Face.
Yeah.
The whole heavens are a face.
Do we know if like, reverie is literal, where this is a night dream? Because then if you're a dreamer, it's a passive experience in a sense.
Yeah.
Yes. True.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's
and
a really
you're
good...
wandering kind of through this.
Yeah.
Totally.
Wow.
And that's one of the effects that's created.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Regardless
that's
of
right.
whether or not it's created, that's part of the, that's so helpful that the passive voice really creates this feeling
yes.
of a reverie.
Things are happening to you.
Things
yes.
are happening to you. So that's really interesting because it means that like nature is really active,
mm-hmm.
but also it's all experienced
mm-hmm.
by someone or by yeah
mm-hmm.
by a dreamer mm-hmm. by someone there. It's a reverie
mm-hmm.
that like that it's that there's active like the mind is active or it's a dreamscape is a mind place
mm-hmm.
a mental state. Okay, so we don't have time to read the whole thing, but I just want to skip to the end. Because I think so, I would totally encourage you to go back through and read the middle part where like more action happens,
okay.
more action of nature happens. Exactly what Robert was saying, that there's all of this action of nature. But let's start again at when curlews cry, which is line 35,
mm-hmm.
and let's read to the end. And Julia, would you pick up?
Okay. When curlews cry beneath the village walls, and to her straggling brood the partridge calls, their short-lived jubilee the creatures keep,
mm.
which but endures while tyrant man
mm.
does sleep.
Mm-hmm.
When a sedate content the spirit feels, and no fierce light disturbs whilst it reveals, but silent musings urge the mind to seek something too high for syllables
mm.
to speak, till the free soul to a composedness charmed, finding the elements of rage disarmed,
mm.
o'er all below a solemn quiet grown, joys in the inferior world, and thinks it like her own. In such a night let me abroad remain, till morning breaks,
mm.
and all's confused again. Our cares, our toils, our clamors are renewed, or pleasures seldom reached, again pursued.
Wow, great.
Thank you.
Wow.
So what is so important, what's so meaningful about night? How does she make night meaningful?
She's in exile, and she's
mm-hmm.
free, finally.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah, what else?
The night of
her
life.
There's rest.
Yeah, there's rest.
Repose.
Yeah.
Repose and composedness,
mm-hmm.
charmed, which is really like a very
yeah.
related word
mm-hmm.
to repose,
mm-hmm.
composedness.
The free soul.
And
the
just,
free soul.
And elements of rage disarmed.
Mm-hmm.
Disarmed. We have another metaphor
yeah.
of
mm-hmm.
far of fighting, of
yes.
arming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, the thing she's removed from is the stuff in the day, which is her cares, her toils, her clamors,
yeah.
or seldom reached pleasures,
yes.
and kind of like futileness.
The futility.
Yeah.
Yeah, yes.
And now we have the narrator. Let
yes.
me.
Yes.
Let
yeah.
me.
Yeah.
I
yeah.
just leaped out when I was reading
yeah.
it. Let me.
Yeah.
It's really weird, too, because in the light, you can see, but here, she sees more clearly in
yeah.
the darkness.
Right.
Yes. Yes, a total paradox.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are so many 18th century nighttime poems
mm-hmm.
that are thinking through exactly that question. Like, how can we see better in the darkness? Yeah. And, like, how does the sense it, like, not having so many senses somehow awaken
mm-hmm.
other senses? Or, yeah.
You can see most, you can hear most clearly and see most clearly when you quiet yourself down and you close your eyes.
Yeah, right. Right.
This is strikingly relevant for me in terms of, you know, I care for people. And this last year has been extremely painful. I have, you know, probably 15 or 20% of our congregation, they feel in exile.
Wow.
They haven't been sent anywhere.
Yeah.
But Tyrant Man, they know exactly who that is.
Yes.
And this sense of they don't know where they are anymore, and
mm-hmm.
you know, perhaps a sense of having a place where they feel safe,
where they belong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, how is it that this world that doesn't really include active humans, right? We talked about how our scene, right? We're at, like, humans are in the passive voice. How is that a world where the soul feels free? Which is when the creatures keep their short-lived jubilee, and tyrant man does sleep, and it's me, the solitary observer, who can experience and describe. How is that? Like, why? How do you hold those two things together?
Well, I feel a bit convicted because I'm tyrant man. I'm the one who lives in the day. I'm the one who seeks my futile pleasures and does have all my cares and everything. And all this stuff is going around me and I don't see it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It reminds me too of Peace of the Wild Things by Barry Wendelberry.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you have the peace and the wild things, which is an interesting image.
Yeah.
There's that sense of when he's tired, when his soul is tired, like he goes to where the Windrake lies. I forget the whole poem, but only in that, in nature, is he finally like himself again.
Mm-hmm.
And in community, it's actually deforming somehow.
Right. And I take that alongside your comment, Robert, that we're still a human. Like, how is the human observer, the me, like the avoidance, the waiting till the end to describe, to introduce the me?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is there some way that the human is also a part of that tyrant man?
Mm-hmm.
Like, not in, there's this real problem of the border between the human and the natural world,
mm-hmm.
and how to navigate that. And I think pronouns is
mm-hmm.
one way that she's very subtly
mm-hmm.
trying to skirt that boundary,
mm-hmm.
To still be a part of this creaturely world,
mm-hmm.
but as a human being, what does that feel? What is that? How is that possible?
Mm-hmm.
Without also hurting the creaturely world or disturbing it.
Yeah.
It's already so short-lived. She's constantly repeating when
mm-hmm.
this happens, when that happens. It's so time-bound,
mm-hmm.
the poem,
mm-hmm.
in terms of this particular time,
mm-hmm.
night, that's going to end. It's going to end.
Mm-hmm.
I'm stuck on the sleep, on the whole. It's probably my ultimate escapist self. It's like sleep is the time that we can restore and regenerate and take on the day. But it's also a way to avoid what you're talking about, like in your, you know, this chaos that's around us and grief and pain, and it's just like, well, I just go to sleep.
Right.
And I'll have a beautiful
mm-hmm.
reverie kind of dream, you know, that will...
I was thinking about reading Ode to a Nightingale with you all,
mm-hmm.
where Keats basically says the same thing.
Uh-huh.
Oh, for a drought of vintage that had been cool. Like, oh, if only I could just get drunk on wine.
Yeah.
Like, that's basically what he says.
Yeah.
After class.
That's right.
Yeah, totally.
And
so it's interesting to encounter for me this poem.
Yeah.
From that period, because I don't see this kind of thinking in present time poetry. I would believe it's not
well,
a lot there.
I mean, I think your question, like one question is this escapism?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Is this just escapism
yeah.
from the toils and the work of human
yeah.
beings during
mm-hmm.
the day?
Mm-hmm.
I think that is a really valid question.
Mm-hmm.
That comes up again and again with like the Romantics after the French Revolution,
mm-hmm.
going to nature,
mm-hmm.
another kind of reclusion, another kind of
yes.
seeking for sustenance, for meaning,
mm-hmm.
for repose.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real question.
I make a case though for hiding,
mm-hmm.
not always escapism.
Yeah.
Every natural creature
yeah.
hides.
Yeah.
Right.
Bears hide and hibernate.
Yeah.
You know, we hide for 9 months before we.
Right.
Yeah, I think there's a case to be made. In an era where everything, we have to share everything. And,
yeah.
For hiding in a healthy way. Like one of the women that I care for, she really is on the edge. I mean, this
mm-hmm.
year is just really, and she has turned to photography, natural photography, and particularly birds. And
mm-hmm.
it is not escapism, as I see it.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually kind of
It's healthy. It's life-giving. Life's restoring.
To have some creative place.
Which I hear in her, like, certainly could be escapism, but I hear it as, like, being remade and kind of, you know, when there's nothing you can do about what the tyrant man has done to you, then there's, but there's living and seeing the pure bird.
Well, if you want to take it even to the most extreme, you look at what happened to people during the Holocaust.
Yes.
And incredible poetry got written,
yes.
and compositions, and they put on plays inside camps.
Yeah.
I mean, there is this place in the human spirit that says, I will not be crushed.
Yeah.
You can crush my body, you cannot crush my spirit, and I will find some way to bring that alive. And maybe that's part of what you can do with the people you're dealing with is help them find ways
that
they can all be celebrated.
Rage against the dying of the light.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's after she's spent all of this time really meticulously describing this natural life, this short-lived jubilee. It's not about human life, it's about natural life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's after that, till the free soul, until the free soul, now free soul, to a composedness charm. So she's composed this scene. She's described it. She's seeing it.
Yes.
Composing is like one way poets talk about writing, making.
Mm-hmm.
And the soul becomes composed, like the poem is composed, charmed.
Mm-hmm.
Finding the elements of rage disarmed, finding them disarmed.
Yeah.
Not that the soul has disarmed them, but that there's something about this composing process that disarms, makes vulnerable, not having the sable armor.
Yeah.
Why does she need to call it an inferior world?
Good question. Yeah,
I recoil at that.
Yeah, so like higher world, like it is a kind of platonic model of like a lower world, like lower versus higher world in that term. We could say there is that word, but like how is she actually referring to these creatures? Is she actually treating them like inferiors?
No, so
humans?
Is she taking kind of the human culture view of them? Is that why she would bring in a term like that?
I mean, she definitely is referring, one thought, it's a great question. One thought that I would have is that she's referring, it's like she's using that as a way to clarify to people what world she's meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So not with any, like, because it would have been so understood what, the inferior meant, like, earthly world, rather than rather than heavenly world, that it's like a way of communicating that she means not...
It would have the same connotation, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely
it would have. Yeah, yeah.
To that, and I'm
yeah.
okay with
up
that.
And down. Yeah.
But that she could have used it, like, it would have had that, but she could have used it as a descriptive way. You could make an argument either way. But given the rest of the poem, given that we've had, 46 lines talking about the intricacies of this world, that, we need to move on, but the likeness, like, what you're pointing to, the inferior world, but the soul thinks the inferior world like her own. So at the same time, Finch is comparing the two.
Right.
She's saying, it's an inferior world. Like, this is a Christian, like, part of this structure of thinking about the earthly versus the heavenly, but kind of complicating that, too, by saying the soul thinks it like her own.
Mm-hmm.
That simile of likeness brings them pretty close together.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really interesting what she's doing and how she's using figurative speech to actually really complicate that hierarchy.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Any, like, last comments before we move on to a writing exercise? Great. Okay, so let's take this. We've talked a lot about specific description. And what I'd like to do is let's actually do this. I was going to have you go outside and then write, but why don't we bring paper outside? And there are clipboards in that cardboard box, so don't get up right now, but after I describe the exercise, you can grab a clipboard and, like, go outside and do it. So what I'm thinking is that it's kind of like what we did this morning, but what I'd like to do is just go outside. There's a beautiful trail that wanders, like, through the woods. You can find a place that's calling to you in the woods, by the river. Take a couple of minutes experiencing. What do you hear? What do you feel? what do you smell? Like, all of your senses. Try to engage. Like, think about all of how your senses are attuned. Mm-hmm. And then free write for, say, 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be for long. 5 minutes, actually, if you time it. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's a substantive amount of time. Mm-hmm. And so what is free writing? What associations do you have with free writing? Okay, so basically what I mean by free writing is try to keep your pen on the paper for the entire 5 minutes.
Whoa. and not doodle.
Exactly. No need to be a monitor on yourself. Whatever comes into your mind after this experience, just write it down. No need to edit. Go for the jugular. That's what one writer says about this. So, like, whatever, like, emotions, anything that's making you, reminding you of. So let's do that and come back, and we'll hopefully have a couple minutes to share.
Okay, I've got a regular pad. So
great, perfect.
Yeah. Okay, so you want us back at what time?
Let's say 3:24. What was your experience of writing, of being present and then responding to being in nature?
Well, I thought I was going to pull in all the senses like you asked us to, and then all of a sudden this huge winged creature landed between Robert and me.
Oh,
and it was either a fly or a wasp that I've never seen before.
Ooh.
So I just turned into a describer of this thing and trying to capture it.
Cool.
And I bent to look at it, and its two little eyeballs went, I don't know how I managed to do that. It didn't seem like they were connected to a head.
We have a couple more minutes. We're just running a couple minutes over. Is that okay?
About my fly wasp.
Oh my gosh. Oh, that's
We're just five more minutes.
An encounter that I would generally avoid, if possible.
No, I love creatures like that.
Do you?
Loved guys like that. Yeah, I wasn't afraid he was going to bite me or anything. He was like this far away.
So how did you write about him? What did that look like in your writing?
Well, I talked about everything it did. Its swiveling and the huge black eyes and the tapering wings and its abdomen coils. And then it flew away. What was it? That's how I ended
it.
So it's just this huge description.
And I love that description is of verbs. Like, you have a lot of verbs in there,
mm-hmm.
a lot of movements,
mm-hmm.
things that it does, and then a couple adjectives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
It's mostly nouns. Yeah,
mostly.
I'm not writing in the 16th or 17th.
but you're describing by giving it actions, by making it do things.
Right.
Or, like, describing what it's doing.
Right.
Yeah, so it becomes an active thing.
Yeah, we were
happening.
Having a relationship, this thing and
right.
I.
Yeah.
Right.
That's cool.
Whatever it was.
Here, I thought you just wanted to sit next to me.
Well, that too.
What else did you notice about how you described nature? Or how you described what you were seeing? Or what you were experiencing? Like the feelings that you had in response?
I noticed that I was... It was encountering nature for me again in the beautiful way up here. But I was including people somehow in the weaving of it because I thought on going down to the river there, I said, who put these rocks in a way that would direct me to that place? And then I love the sound of the river. And then I was hearing the rocks interrupting the flow. Like this, the unknown human, an unknown person.
Yeah.
I just said an unknown.
Yeah.
I would be interrupted in that reverie of listening to the stream. And
yeah.
So it was the nameless whoever.
That's lovely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
Cool.
Huh. It's a real
question.
Yeah.
I found it to be a sacred thing. To be sitting and listening to the creek and just kind of looking at the needles on the ground and the tree, the image of trees speaking to me is really strong because of our class this morning. Wes Howard Brook mentioned that. It's just something that's rattling around in my brain now, right now.
You know what's been off of what you're saying, Tom, is that nothing is insignificant.
No.
I mean, that's kind of what we were charged to do.
Right.
Go out there and just notice.
Yeah.
But so that's
yeah.
the sacredness of it. Nothing can just be pushed aside as,
no.
oh, well.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
all.
Yeah.
So when I hear what your description,
yeah.
to me,
thank
okay,
you.
That's where it takes me.
And working, it's a community out there.
Yeah.
Too.
And that trees can speak.
Yes.
Like you could have a dialogue with trees.
Yes.
Mountain
yeah.
speak.
Yeah. Mountain speak.
Rock
exactly.
Speak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speak,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the question
yeah.
from my
yeah.
mind is, whose voice is it? When you
right.
write the tree speaking,
yeah.
whose voice is it?
I don't know.
I looked at the. It's like when I looked up at the mountains, they were like people, and even the flies and the deer and all of that. They were all. It was all good and right and God and I'm gonna read this.
Yeah. Are you all okay staying a couple minutes over?
Yeah.
I'm really
yeah,
sorry I kept you over. It does go till 4, so you should still
get it. So you get a couple. You only have a little bit of time.
I know. Sure.
Oh, good.
While mountains peaks rest amid the mist, and the brook speaks unto their crest, while deer browse quietly within the green, and the flies alight to kiss my skin clean. I wonder at our future, for our children's sake. The empire grows, God's world it forsakes. What treasures are worth more than what God has wrought? Have those in power even given it thought?
Oh, wow.
That's what I do.
I love the while. I love that you repeat. This the while this happens, while
yeah,
this
while
happens,
happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that it's such a helpful way of framing all of these questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Yeah, it's like that really bugging me right now. The whole thing about the
mm-hmm.
Wes Howard Brook, the empire
mm-hmm.
speaking. You know, the two side by side, the creation and the empire.
And I think we can see that tension too in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
Is this question between nature versus the tyrant man,
yeah.
and like these
mm-hmm.
different kinds of models
mm-hmm.
of living, of being,
mm-hmm.
and there are different ways of framing those different models.
Yeah.
But I think that's a real question. That
mm-hmm.
yeah, yeah.
How about yours?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I it was the boys actually really annoyed me.
It didn't intrude in my little reverie as well, and I
decided to kind of be like, instead of having this, you know, lovely curated maybe I'll just sit with that annoyance.
Yeah.
So actually I wrote more about the boys and their rocks, and one was older and one was younger, and the younger was having a hard time with his skipping, his conjuring of the magic circles across the waters below. But I was amazed at how he just kept at it and wasn't frustrated. So I thought of how hard it is to grow up. But their relationship with nature was more. It was related, but there was a mastery.
Yes.
And I thought it's been sitting where we were, where you're facing where the mind was. I mean, theirs was playful, obviously ours
yeah.
wasn't
yes.
with the mind. But it's a complicated
yeah.
relationship. So I just decided to be annoyed with them and
yeah.
use that to write. So
yeah.
Great.
Well, it's interesting having quote unquote the poet's mind and eyes of looking at something like that, you can actually change it around into something really meaningful
yeah.
rather than annoyance.
The poet is framing, the poet is composing
yeah.
yes.
a theme. It has a making formative power.
Well,
and speaking to
yeah.
someone else, as you
Let,
did
I
in
just,
your poem. That's good questions.
As a preacher, I mean, texts that you like are almost always make for the worst sermons.
Yeah.
Texts that
so
you off.
Yeah.
Those are fantastic.
Your juices.
So actually, I mean, I love things that annoy me.
Oh,
interesting. I'm annoyed. So
yes, there's something there.
Then my tension's
wow.
there, and my
wow.
yeah.
that's cool.
Yeah,
I've heard someone say, I need to be annoyed because I know that's what I'm going to learn something.
Right, yeah, I'm that way. I know that about myself. So annoyance isn't like a bad thing to me. It's more like a,
Yeah.
Wow.
That's cool. That's really something to keep in mind. And that is like a strategy for writing. Like something that's driving, like you can't quite figure out. You can't quite like grapple with.
I know ice cream is limiting.
Yes, we need to stop.
I just want to ask you one question and I'll ask to follow up on Thursday. When do we meet again?
Yeah, Thursday.
I noticed Robert's style was more of a versey, almost like a verse.
Yep, with rhymes.
Yeah.
Which
and,
is,
And I don't know. Yeah, and I'm saying I just kind of
total
let it
I just wrote because that's where I was told.
That's totally great. Any and all of the above. Totally great.
Okay.
There's like long histories of thinking about poetic form. You don't need to know, but right now anything anything goes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes,
all good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you all so much.
Thank you
so much for all of your like. This was such a good like helpful.
Really
great.
Cool.